I want you to close your eyes for a second. Well, unless you're driving. Please keep them open if you're driving.
Definitely keep them open.
Right. But I want you to picture the concept of truth, like with a capital T. When you just think of that word, what pops into your head?
I mean, for most people, it's something static, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Do you see like a marble statue on a mountaintop? Something eternal, fixed, unchangeable. Just sort of sitting there waiting for us to climb up and discover it.
That is the traditional view, absolutely. It's what philosophers call the spectator view of reality. You know, you stand back, you observe, and you find the diamond that's just been buried there forever.
Right. But what if I told you that truth isn't a diamond?
Okay.
What if truth is a hammer? Or like a screwdriver? What if truth is simply what works?
Now you're walking right through the door of American pragmatism.
And that is exactly where we are heading today. We are doing a deep dive into the world of John Dewey. In philosophy circles, they call him the Big D.
The Big D, yeah.
He lived from 1859 all the way to 1952. No. So he effectively bridged the Victorian era and the Atomic Age.
And his influence is just, it's massive. If you've ever gone to a school where you learned by doing a project rather than just, you know, memorizing Latin roots or whatever, you have John Dewey to thank.
Right.
But today, based on this fascinating lecture by Dr. Arthur Holmes and our whole stack of research here, we aren't just looking at his resume. We're looking at his core mission.
Which is evolutionary naturalism.
Exactly.
Which, I got to say, sounds a lot like a biology course.
It starts there. But the mission was to take Darwin's theory of natural selection, you know, survival of the fittest, and apply it to everything.
Like everything. Everything.
I mean, everything. Logic, art, ethics, how we think. Dewey argues that human thought isn't some divine spark or a perfect mirror of reality.
Okay.
It's a biological tool for survival, just like a claw or a wing or a beaver's tail.
That is a huge shift in how we view ourselves. And to guide us through this, we're unpacking Dr. Holmes's analysis of American pragmatism. It's really a fascinating look at how this philosophy actually plays out in real life for you and me.
It really is.
But the source material makes it pretty clear that before we get to Dewey, we have to set the stage. We have to talk about the man who really kicked this whole thing off, which is William James.
The godfather of pragmatism, effectively. You really can't understand Dewey without James.
So let's unpack James first. Dr. Holmes points out that James developed something he called radical empiricism.
Right.
Now, I know empiricism generally means knowledge comes from experience, right?
Yeah.
Senses, touch, sight.
Yeah.
But why did James feel the need to call it radical? Was he just trying to be edgy?
In a way, yes. He felt the classic empiricists like John Locke just weren't taking it far enough.
How so?
Well, James argued that a philosophical dispute is only meaningful if it has actual practical consequences. He had this litmus test.
Okay, lay it on me.
If you and I are arguing about the nature of the universe, say free will versus determinism or matter versus mind, and let's say we have this huge debate.
Right.
But no matter who wins the debate, our actual daily experience doesn't change at all.
Then what's the point?
Exactly. If it doesn't change how you live your life, the argument is meaningless.
So if it doesn't make a difference to my Tuesday morning commute, it's literally not worth discussing.
Precisely. It's the pragmatic theory of meaning. Meaning equals consequences. And this leads to his famous and frankly somewhat controversial idea called the will to believe.
I love this concept. But it also feels a little slippery.
It can be.
Because the source material explicitly contrasts this with a guy named W.K. Clifford. And Clifford was this very strict, rigorous thinker who basically said, I think the quote is, "It is wrong, always, everywhere, and for anyone to believe anything upon insufficient evidence."
Yeah, that's the ethics of belief. If you can't logically prove it, you aren't allowed to believe it. It's very scientific, very rigid.
Right. And William James looks at that and says, well, hold on. That's actually impossible.
Because it is.
He argues that sometimes life forces us to make momentous choices where the evidence just isn't clear. We can't just sit on the fence forever.
You have to act.
Right. And in those cases, James says we have a right to believe based on what helps us psychologically.
This is the key right here. For James, concrete experience includes your psychological well-being.
Cool.
So if believing in free will, for example, makes you function better, feel less despair, get out of bed in the morning, then that belief has what he calls cash value.
Cash value. I like that.
It works. Therefore, you are justified in holding it.
It's validating the subjective experience as a totally legitimate form of evidence.
Exactly.
And speaking of subjective, here's where it gets really interesting to me. Dr. Holmes shares this brilliant insight about how our personalities actually shape our philosophies.
Oh, the tough-minded versus tender-minded distinction.
Yes, yeah. He mentions James's distinction there, and it's this fascinating psychological take on the whole history of thought.
We like to think philosophy is pure logic, right? Just math with words. But James says it's often just a confession of the philosopher's personality.
Which is so true. The source asks this hilarious question. Could a California hippie have written Immanuel Kant's Critique of Pure Reason?
And the answer is a resounding probably not.
Right. Because Kant was this very strict Prussian bachelor. He was so organized, so meticulous, that his neighbors literally set their clocks by his daily walks.
He was a machine.
A machine of routine. And his philosophy totally reflects that. It's structured, it's rigid, categorical.
Whereas a more laid-back personality, you know, the California hippie archetype,
yeah,
they would likely produce a philosophy that is more fluid, perhaps mystical or relativistic. The takeaway here isn't just a joke about personalities. It's that we think the way we are wired to think.
Which is the perfect segue to John Dewey. Because if James opened the door to psychology, Dewey just knocked down the whole house and rebuilt it on biology.
He really did.
Yeah.
This is the absolute heart of evolutionary naturalism. Dewey rejects what he calls the spectator theory of knowledge.
And he contrasts this with René Descartes. We all picture Descartes.
Right.
Sitting alone in his stove-heated room, doubting everything, thinking, I think, therefore I am.
Right.
Just a brain in a box.
Exactly. The stove-heated room is the ultimate symbol of isolation. It's a mind cut off from the world, trying to find truth through pure abstract contemplation.
And Dewey says
that is biological nonsense. We are not brains in boxes.
Right.
We are organisms constantly interacting with an environment. We are in the mud, in the world, trying to survive.
And this brings us to, honestly, one of the best analogies in the entire lecture. To explain how we usually exist in the world, the source brings up the fluid drive of a 1946 Dodge.
A very specific classic car record.
Very specific. And for those who haven't driven a 46 Dodge lately.
It's just most of us.
Right, myself included. But the fluid drive was this early technology that made shifting gears incredibly smooth. You were hardly conscious of the shift at all.
And that is what Dewey calls fluid experience. Dewey says 99% of our lives are lived exactly like that.
On autopilot.
Yes. We run on habit. We brush our teeth. We drive to work. We pour coffee. We aren't really thinking in a deep philosophical sense. We are just flowing through our environment.
Until the fluid drive breaks.
The problem situation, this is central to Dewey. We only start truly thinking when our habits fail us.
So the source tells this story about driving in Seattle. Now, if you've been to Seattle, you know the hills are terrifyingly steep.
Oh, yeah. And they have stop signs at the very top, which is just cruel.
It's terrible city planning. So imagine you're used to driving in flat country. That's your fluid experience. You're on autopilot.
Right.
Suddenly, you're on a 45-degree incline, stopped, with a car right on your bumper behind you. Your normal habit of just hitting the gas won't work. You'll roll backward and crash.
That panic you feel, that disruption, that is the birth of intelligence.
So what actually happens in that moment?
You have to engage your mind. You look at the situation, you formulate a plan. In the story, the driver thinks, okay, handbrake on, clutch in, rev the gas, release brake slowly. That process is thinking.
It's basically a dialectic, right? Like thesis, antithesis?
Ideally, yes. You have the thesis, which is your habit, driving normally.
Okay.
Then the antithesis, the problem, the steep hill and the stop sign.
Right.
The thinking process leads to the synthesis, which is the new technique using the handbrake. And once that works, it becomes your new habit. You go back to fluid experience.
So intelligence isn't about contemplating the eternal forms of beauty or justice. It's just about not rolling backward into a Prius.
Essentially, yes. Thinking is just a tool to repair fluid experience when it breaks. It is purely functional.
And this functional view changes how we look at science and truth, too.
Yeah.
Which leads us to a concept called operationalism.
Yes.
Now, this sounds highly technical, but let's break it down.
Well, it comes from a physicist named Percy Bridgman originally, but Dewey adopted it wholeheartedly. It's the idea that a scientific concept only means something based on the operations you use to measure it.
Let's unpack that with the example from the source, which is mineralogy.
Yeah.
The Mohs hardness scale.
Right.
We learn in school that diamonds are hard and talc is soft.
Yeah.
And I always assumed hardness was something inside the rock, Like, The Rock possesses a spirit of hardness.
Sure, an inherent property. But Dewey and Bridgman would say hardness isn't some invisible inner essence. Hardness is simply relative scratchability.
Relative scratchability. I love that term so much.
It's the reality of it. If Rock A scratches Rock B, then A is harder. That is the entire definition.
Wow.
The meaning of the concept is the operation, the scratching itself. If you can't perform the operation, the concept practically doesn't exist.
So science doesn't tell us what a rock is deep down. It only tells us what a rock does when we mess with it.
Precisely. This is called instrumentalism. It's an anti-realist view of science.
Anti-realist meaning?
Meaning it says scientific theories aren't perfect pictures of reality. They are instruments, tools to manipulate the world.
Okay.
It's like why a lot of students major in science. They aren't doing it to gaze at the universe and ponder its mysteries. They do it for what they can do with it. Medicine, engineering, technology. It's entirely about utility.
Which brings us to how we make decisions. Because if logic isn't about abstract truth, but about solving problems, Dewey says we need a new kind of logic entirely. He calls it experimental logic.
Right. He throws out the old formal syllogisms.
You know the ones. Mm. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal.
Dewey says that's not how we actually think in the real world.
The source gives a great example of this. Imagine a farm wagon pulling out in front of you on the highway.
A classic problem situation.
You don't do a syllogism in that moment. You don't say, all wagons are slow, this is a wagon, therefore I should brake.
No, you'd crash.
Exactly. You react. You slam the brakes. You swerve. You rely on what Dewey calls funded experience, your whole history of driving.
But what if you can't just react? What if the problem is completely new?
Like what?
Well, the lecture details a story about a man trying to get to a job interview. He takes a path he knows, but when he gets to the creek, the bridge is gone, washed away.
Total disruption of habit. You can't just keep walking.
So he stops. He has to perform mental experiments. This is crucial for Dewey. An idea is simply a plan for action.
Okay.
So the man runs simulations in his head. If I go back to the road, I'll be late for the interview. If I walk upstream, maybe I find a crossing, maybe I don't.
Then he looks at the creek and thinks, maybe I can jump it.
That is the hypothesis. But here is the kicker. Is the idea, I can jump this creek, true?
Well, historically, we'd say it's either true or false right then and there. He either physically has the ability or he doesn't.
Not for Dewey.
No.
Dewey says the idea isn't true yet. It isn't true until he verifies it. Oh. He practices a few jumps on the bank. That's the experiment. Then he commits. He jumps. If he lands on the other side dry and makes the interview, then and only then has the idea become true.
Verification is making it true. That is such a wild concept to wrap your head around. Truth isn't a property of the idea just sitting in his head. Truth is what happens when the idea meets the world and succeeds.
It's the logic of the broken bridge. Mm-hmm. Ideas are just bridges we build to get over problems. If the bridge holds, it's a good bridge. If it collapses, it was false.
Okay, so if truth is just what works and thinking is just a survival tool,
yeah.
What does this do to ethics? Mm. What happens to good and evil?
This is where Dewey gets very controversial for traditionalists. Remember, he completely rejects Aristotle. He rejects the idea of a telos.
Remind us what telos is.
A fixed supreme end or goal for human life.
So there's no big meaning of life written in the stars.
No. For Dewey, there are no fixed ends. There are only ends in view. We have specific goals for specific problems.
The source makes a really interesting distinction here between value and valuing.
Right. We tend to think of values as these nouns. Justice, courage, honesty, things that exist on a pedestal. Yeah. Dewey says, no, valuing is a verb. It arises from biological need. You don't value avoiding a wagon until the wagon is in front of you. Then you value it very highly.
So values are just tools for survival in a specific moment.
Essentially, yes. He calls it instrumental ethics. And this paved the way for situation ethics later on.
Okay.
The idea is that there are no universal moral rules that apply everywhere, all the time. Every single moral dilemma is a unique problem situation that needs a unique solution to satisfy the needs of the people involved.
That sounds incredibly flexible, but also a little unmoored.
It is unmoored from tradition, certainly, but Dewey would say it's realistic. And he applied this to education, too. His book, Democracy in Education, is arguably his most famous work.
This is the learning to live stuff.
Yes. If there are no fixed truths to memorize, then the point of school isn't to download the great books into a child's brain. It's to teach them how to solve problems.
How to fix the fluid drive.
Exactly. It's about giving them the skills to adapt to a changing environment.
So it's totally student-oriented, not discipline-oriented.
Exactly. It's not about knowing what Plato said in a cave. It's about knowing what to do when your bridge is washed out.
So we've tackled truth, logic, science, ethics, and education, which is a lot.
It's a massive system.
But that leaves one big one, religion.
And Dewey tackles it head on in his book, A Common Faith.
Given everything we've said, you know, the biology, the tools, the total lack of fixed truth, I'm guessing he's not a fan of organized dogmas.
You guessed right. Since there are no fixed eternal truths, religion cannot be about believing in a set of unchangeable doctrines. But Dewey didn't want to throw religion out entirely. He wanted to redefine it.
The source brings up the etymology of the word religion, which I actually didn't know before reading this.
Yes, it comes from the Latin religare, meaning to retie or to bind together.
Bind together.
Dewey loved this. He saw religion not as a connection to the supernatural, but as a connection to the community, an adjustment to the world around us.
So what is God in this system? Is there a God?
For Dewey, God is not a being. God is a symbol.
A symbol for what?
It's a symbol representing the united ideals of a community. When a community comes together and agrees on what they strive for, say, love, justice, peace, that collection of ideals is God.
That is a massive shift. It sounds very humanist.
It is explicitly humanist. Dewey was actually one of the original signers of the Humanist Manifesto back in the 1930s.
Oh, I've heard of that.
Yeah, it declared that the universe is self-existing, not created, that humans are just a part of nature, and that religion is a product of human interaction, not divine revelation.
The source compares this to modern Unitarian Universalism.
It's a very apt comparison. In many modern secular or Unitarian contexts, the focus is entirely on shared values and community support, the retying, right?
Right.
Rather than on whether everyone believes in the exact same deity or scripture. Dewey was basically predicting, or perhaps even creating, that modern secular spirituality.
So let's zoom out and look at the whole picture here. We started with Descartes in a stove-heated room, trying to think his way to truth.
Pure isolation.
Right. And we ended up in a 1946 Dodge, cruising on fluid drive, using our brains, only when we hit a steep hill in Seattle.
It's a journey from the mind as a mirror of reality to the mind as a Swiss Army knife for survival.
And it really challenges the way we look at everything. It asks us to stop asking, is this true with a capital T, and start asking, does this work?
Which is the ultimate American philosophical question. It's pragmatic, it's efficient.
But it leaves us with something pretty heavy to ponder.
It definitely does.
Yeah, and this is the thought I want to leave you with today. Dewey's system is brilliant for solving problems like a broken bridge or a steep hill. But there is a potential shadow side to this whole tool analogy.
Go on.
If truth is only what works and values are just tools we invent to survive,
yeah.
What happens when what works for me completely destroys what works for you?
That is the danger. Without a fixed standard, without that marble statue on the mountaintop to judge us both, do we have any way to say who is actually right?
Right.
Or does it just become a contest of who can adapt or dominate better?
And that is the problem situation we are going to leave you to solve on your own.
Good luck with that one.
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive into John Dewey.
Keep thinking.
We'll see you next time.